Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, June 20th, 2018. This is the 181st episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an award-winning chef from New Orleans who has a new hospitality group and a new book, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be optimistic. Always think positively. Let's face it, life is going to happen, and it's not going to be perfect. There may be bumps in the road and curveballs thrown at you, but with the right mindset, you can handle anything and turn less fortunate circumstances into better ones. It's all a matter of perspective. Think of the glass half full rather than empty and believe in the light at the end of the tunnel, as everything has a silver lining. That's my tip today. Now, we had a snow delay previously with my guest, but I'm super excited to have rescheduled with him for the show. So my guest today is Alon Shaya. He is an award-winning chef and founder of Pomegranate Hospitality, which he founded in 2017 to create a space where meaningful, lasting relationships are created, community engagement prospers, and cultural differences are celebrated. His restaurants include newly opened Saba in New Orleans and Safta, soon to open at the Source Hotel in Denver. Alon has been nominated for 5 James Beard Awards, and he has won the Best Chef South while at Dominica in 2015, and Shaya won for Best New Restaurant in 2016, and he has a new cookbook memoir out called Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. So welcome, Shaya. Welcome, Shaya. Welcome, Alon.
Hi, how are you, Sherry?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to have you on. And I was thinking of you this past weekend because I saw you were in Aspen, and I know I've met you from going to so many food and wine festivals, yeah. But I wasn't there this year, so I missed seeing you.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I always see you at, we always run into each other at those festivals, which is always great. I missed seeing you this year, so I'm glad we're having a chance to talk on the phone now.
Yeah, me too. So I always like to start my show with my guests and find out about their background and how they got into the culinary and hospitality industry. So let's start there. When did you know you wanted to be a chef?
I guess officially I knew I wanted to be a chef when I was 15 years old. And, I had an inclination that that's what I was wanting to do. I didn't know that I was actually going to pursue that career until, I was 16 years old when I got my first job in a fine dining restaurant.
Okay. What was the turning moment?
Well, the turning moment specifically was I was working as a prep cook at this restaurant called Sonoma in Manayunk, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of, it's part of Philadelphia. And I remember I was peeling like 3 cases of red bell peppers after they had been roasted. And I was like taking all of the charred skin off, and I was probably moving very slow, and it was taking forever. And I remember being there on the line, and there was this wood-burning oven, and the chef, whose name was Don, was making a pizza. And he had put it in the wood-burning oven and pulled it out. And it was like goat cheese and arugula. And as the pizza came out of the oven, he started layering like slices of smoked salmon on top. And, you know, that was very classic, like, 90s, you know, Cal Italian cuisine at that time. And I saw the pizza with its blistered edges and smoked salmon being put on top. And I kind of felt these, like, butterflies in my stomach and knew at that moment that that was the career that I wanted to take and I wanted to become a chef.
Wow. It's so vivid for you that was when.
Yeah, it was exactly the moment. You know, up until that point, I, you know, was kind of toying around with the idea. I didn't quite know. I never really had any plans for what I was going to do. And I wasn't pursuing, like, signing up for any college or anything like that. And no one was really pressuring me to do that either. So I was kind of like this feral kid, you know, just like roaming the streets and going to school whenever I wanted to. But I never really had a plan. And my home economics teacher, Donna Barnett, was the one that got me a job in a restaurant, the one that I was just mentioning, Sonoma. And she had really noticed that I had a passion for food and for cooking. And she really saved my life and got me set on the right track. And then it was that at that restaurant that kind of everything started coming together for me.
Right. So what led you down to New Orleans? Because I know from a longer bio that you were born in Israel and then you were raised in Philadelphia, which I know your relationship with this restaurant being close to Philly or part of Philly. I always associate you with New Orleans. So
yeah, for sure. I moved to New Orleans 15 years ago in 2003. And I always really had it on my hit list to go down there because before I even knew that I wanted to be a chef, I remember watching Paul Prudhomme and Emeril Lagasse on television as a kid and just really finding what they were doing to be so fascinating. I felt like they were otherworldly and like what they were doing came from like a different planet, like the food that they were cooking was not anything that I had ever seen or had any experience with. outside of those shows. And, you know, when Paul Prudhomme would be sitting on his chair in front of a cast iron skillet and browning ground beef and livers for dirty rice with garlic and onions and, you know, all these fresh herbs, I remember thinking, like, God, that is something that I want to learn how to do, and I want to be around. I was so kind of intrigued by what they were doing, the style of food they were cooking. And so I always had New Orleans on my list, even before I knew it.
Yeah, well, I love New Orleans. It's a fabulous city for many reasons, and the food is certainly a part high on my list of that. And so what brought you then down there?
So I was working with Harris Corporation.
Okay.
You know, after culinary school, I had moved to Las Vegas and started working in the casinos out there. I worked for Jean-Louis Pelladin, who was, you know, this very amazing French chef that kind of came out of D.C. He had a restaurant called the Watergate in D.C. and opened a restaurant called the Napa Room at the Rio in Las Vegas. And I was working there a little bit. I was working in an Italian restaurant called Antonio's for a little bit. And when I was there at Antonio's, the Harris Corporation had approached me to open a version of Antonio's in St. Louis. So I moved to St. Louis, did that for a couple years. And then there was a spot open at Harris in New Orleans, and I jumped on it. And once that position opened up as the chef of the buffet in New Orleans, I jumped on it and I went. So it brought me down there in 2003.
Okay. And then you joined with the Besh Group. You were executive chef and partner with Dominica, Pizza Dominica, and Shia.
Dominica.
Dominica. I'm sorry, saying it wrong.
Yep.
Before
that, I had lived in Italy for a while and apprenticed out there, and then really kind of trained in how to cook like an Italian grandmother, and I came back to New Orleans after that stint in Italy to open Dominica in 2009.
Okay. Yeah, because you have the Italian and Israeli influence, I know, on your menus and in your cuisine. So that's where I've never thought of you as an Italian grandmother until now, though.
Yeah, technically I've never been an Italian grandmother, but I always tried to cook like one. And I learned from several of them living in Parma and Bergamo. And I always kind of had this love of Italian food from a young age as well. But way before I discovered my love for Israeli food, the restaurants that I had been working at were mostly Italian. So I figured that I would move to Italy and apprentice out there and really kind of hone those Italian skills.
Right. And you did. I mean, you gained a lot of recognition for your cooking and some of the awards I had mentioned, and I don't know when to go into the questions I had from my last guest, but maybe I'll do that now before my last break. We'll just jump in, because I tie every show together. And since we had rescheduled, I have a bunch of questions, and two of them from my past guests are a bit similar. So on episode 170, I had on Lynette Marrero and Ivy Mix, the co-founder of Speed Rack. And Lynette's question was, how do you go through a public breakup and turn around and reinvent and revise yourself? And then last week on 180, I had on Howie Kahn, the writer and contributing editor at the Wall Street Journal and the host and editor-in-chief of Prince Street Podcast. And his question is, as you were involved in a legal battle with your former boss, how did you physically react to having to fight for your own name? So they're talking about working with John Besh, who you've split from, and they're heavy questions.
Yeah, and you know, I'll refer back to your tip of being optimistic and keeping the glass half full. because that's what I feel that you know, my wife Emily and I have been doing definitely over the last year or so. But with the creation of Pomegranate Hospitality, it wasn't a reinvention at all. It was more of a enlightenment, I would say, in a moment to you know, reflect and say, what is the most important thing for us in our lives? Like, how do we make sure that we create happiness not only for ourselves but for the people that we care about and that the people that are around us and that depend on us? And that's really what Pomegranate Hospitality, how it was started, by that kind of sense of optimism and that sense of, you know, this sense that we really wanted to be true to ourselves. So we started Pomegranate Hospitality and brought on our amazing team of people. James Beard Award winner Zach Engel is on our team as the culinary director, and Kara Peterson is our chef de cuisine at Saba, and Jessica Retief is our general manager at Saba, and Susie Dare is our director of people and culture, and Sean Courtney is our director of operations. So all of these people joined our team before any restaurant was even in the picture to open. And this was the team that all was bought into an ideal, you know, which is our mission statement, which says that we're going to create a safe and comfortable work environment for people, and we're going to do everything that we can to make sure that people feel empowered and that there's respect and accountability and there's communication and organization, all these things that are very important. We got together and created a set of values for our company that we work towards every day and that we've embedded into every piece of how we operate, from recruitment to the first 90 days of employment, where there's a coffee chat at the end of the first 30 days, where we sit with our team members and we listen to them and ask them, you know, what their experience has been like. You know, all of these things are really built off of a structure that we've put together with the help of our team to ensure that we're living up to our values. So that, to me, is everything we've been focusing on, and my most important role is to protect that. And that's what we've been spending so much time thinking about and doing over the last several months.
Yes, and I'm glad my tip tied in with that, and I thought it did, and I think that's wonderful. So on that note, let's take a little break, and then we're going to come back and we're talk more with Ron about his new hospitality group, Pomegranate Hospitality. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest is Chef Alon Shaya of Pomegranate Hospitality. And he also has a new cookbook memoir, Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. So Let's talk more about your new hospitality group that you started, because you have some new restaurants that I need to get to soon.
Yeah. Yes, please.
So first, in New Orleans, you have opened Saba.
Yep. We opened Saba in the beginning of May. And we really have this amazing team there. Everyone's been really doing such a great job and putting everything that they have into like living up to everything that we've promised each other that we would do, from our values for Pomegranate. And we've been having a lot of fun making hummus and baking pita bread in a wood burning oven and taking care of our neighbors and the New Orleans community. So it's been great. It's been a dream.
Yeah. So what's the menu and the concept behind it?
Well, it's modern Israeli food. So it's really a blend of cultures that make up what is being cooked and eaten in Israel throughout the country today. So, you know, there's Bulgarian influence and Moroccan and Syrian and Greek and Palestinian influence and all of these really strong food cultures that have come together into this land and have cooked for each other. And I find that to be kind of this endless journey of discovery, because there's so many layers there, and it's so deep and so important to people that I find myself learning more and more about it every day. But essentially, what we do is cook this great food that the basis of the menu, which really centers around hummus and all these different amazing things that we put on top. Like currently we're doing hummus with jumbo lump blue crab meat and corn that's been kind of tossed in fresh butter with herbs like chives and a little bit of lemon. And that is really tasty on hummus, believe it or not, with some pita bread. It's super good.
No, it sounds delicious. I want it right now.
Yeah. We've also just recently put on the menu stewed okra that, you know, we buy from the markets in New Orleans and stew down with tomatoes, and also then get some chicken skins that we make really crispy in the oven with chicken fat. It's called gribbiness, and we toss all these gribbiness on top of the stewed okra with tomatoes and garlic on top of the hummus. So there's this great like southern feel to it. But, you know, of course, okra is like this really popular and very readily available ingredient in Israel as well. So it wouldn't be something that would be too foreign out there.
Right.
And then, yeah. And then we have like all these other parts of the menu. One is at Saba, we do a menu item. We do several menu items that we cook over charcoal in the kitchen. And that's kind of very typical of what you'll see through a lot of casual family style restaurants in Israel, where they skewer all of these different meats and seafood and cook them over hot coals and serve them with a variety of salatin, like tabbouleh or tahini or labneh or harissa, baba ganoush and lutenitsa, which my grandmother taught me how to make. It's this roasted pepper and eggplant dip. And when you kind of load up the table with all of these foods that have been either cooked in a wood-burning oven or kind of kissed over these hot charcoals and then served with something really simple, and then you put that alongside fresh baked pita bread, it's really a lot of fun to eat and a lot of opportunities to kind of pass food around.
Absolutely. I'm in. and so what about Denver? What brought you out there? And you're opening a place soon, Safta, or is
yeah.
that-
So Saba means grandfather in Hebrew, and Safta means grandmother. And we're opening Safta in Denver at the Source Hotel this August. So really what brought us to Denver, my wife Emily and I, is our quest for happiness. Like I said earlier, you know, we're very happy out there. We enjoy our time when we're in Colorado. We've been there several times over the last decade or so. We go at least once a year, and it's just kind of been our happy place. When we're away from New Orleans, we really love being there. So we decided that that was where we wanted to open another business, and our team was very excited about that as well. And so, you know, we're doing some great work out there, and we're ready to get the doors open in August.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, I know there's a lot happening with the Denver dining scene is keeps getting stronger. So
it is. It's an amazing community. Really, really great chefs out there that are very welcoming, and everyone has been very nice. And the community as a whole really has this great sense of optimism. I think, like, if I could paraphrase, you know, what I feel when I'm in Denver, and what I see people kind of exude is the sense of optimism out there. It's still like the Wild West in the sense of, like, you can go out there and put a flag down and make something happen. And I really believe that about Denver, and that's what has drawn Emily and I to it.
Yeah, well, it's just so beautiful, that nature surrounding. So let's talk a little about your cookbook memoir that, I mean, when you're talking about all these recipes that you have at your restaurant, I was thinking they're in the book, or there's versions or similarities of things that you've included. And you also, I know in writing the book, it's not just recipes. It's there's a story, lots of stories about your life.
So. Yeah. Yeah. It kind of, first I want to mention that the team that I worked with to put the book together was just second to none. They're really the best people ever. Tina Angelini helped me with the writing, and Francis Rodriguez did all these beautiful illustrations, and Remy Robert helped with all the recipe testing, and Rush Jago was our photographer, and then my wife Emily did all the styling for the book. So it was kind of like this great group of people working on it, and our vision really kind of came alive in it. You know, the book was supposed to, to me, I wanted it to tell stories, and from the stories come recipes. And that's kind of the way that I approach food in general, whether I'm cooking it that way at my restaurant or at my house. Like, I like to kind of tie everything that I do back to a specific story or a memory. So there's like 26 short stories that are all in chronological order that really kind of depict moments in my life where doing everything from, you know, searching for my identity, trying to learn how to speak English after moving to America, you know, getting in trouble at school, discovering my love for food and my then opportunity and luck to get into culinary school. And then, you know, what happened from there and how I kind of learned how to manage and how to discover my kind of reentry into cooking Israeli food for a living and all of the steps in between. So there's so many stories there about identity and about this journey and the search for it. And then the successes that came from that, and then the failures that came from that. And that I think is a kind of a story we all have to tell about our lives. And I did it and then wrote some recipes with it. And it's a lot of fun, because when you read the stories, I hope that they inspire you to cook the recipes. That's kind of the beauty of it.
I think they do, because I was looking through the book and it was, I was getting motivated to maybe cook a little more than I do, because I just dine out a lot. But
like one good example of that was a chapter called Steak for My Saba, which was this chapter about my grandfather coming to visit me after I had moved to Las Vegas and started my career, and how proud I was to show him, like, you know, that I had my own apartment and that I had this job, and I was an apprentice sous chef, and I was a manager, and like I was so proud of myself. And when he came, I wanted to really kind of show all that off. And he came into the restaurant that I was cooking, Antonio's restaurant, and you know, I sent him out a bunch of food, and then at the end of his meal, he was like, "Well, where's the check?" And I was like, "Oh no, there's no check. Like, you know, this was all. I'm a manager here. I can send all this out and I won't get in trouble for it." And I remember him like just laying into me, being like, you know, this is other people's money. You don't have this kind of authority. Like, you shouldn't be doing this. This isn't the way to like to operate. Like, you know, this is money comes from somewhere. It's not just made up." And he really kind of put me back in my place and put me into like taught me this really, really important lesson in life about humility and about taking my time with where I was going. And by the end of his visit, I realized that, you know, he was going back to Israel and I was never going to see him again because he was dying of lung cancer at the time. And I cooked him a steak, you know, a very simple steak in a cast iron skillet. And you know, by the end of his visit, I kind of realized that I needed to do something like very simple for him. And I remember him wanting to eat the steak well done, you know, and that kind of bothered me because I knew that it would be like not flavorful and, you know, really dry. And I was like, "Saba, are you sure I shouldn't make it medium rare?" And he's like, "No, I like it well done." And I was like, all right, I'll make it well done. And, but you know, that was an important lesson too, that he taught. And you know, that was my last time seeing him, was having that visit with him in Las Vegas. And then the chapter turns into the recipes, and there's a very simple steak recipe of a cast iron roasted ribeye. And then there's a very simple chimichurri recipe that goes with it that's laced with za'atar. And, you know, that is like, I want people to read those stories, and then I want them to feel like the food and the recipes in that chapter have a story and have a meaning to them.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. I love that it's that you've shared so many stories and you're tying your life experiences into the recipes. I think it does motivate people to cook and experience the food beyond just, you know, making a delicious meal. At least does. At least it does to me.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Yeah,
and I've done my job.
Yeah, you have.
Good.
Yeah, we're gonna take another break. But I had one other question from Ivy Mix when she was on the show, and when you mentioned Israel, I was thinking about it. So, what's your favorite restaurant and or bar in Israel right now? She was there in 2016. I haven't been there since 1990,
I'm due to
go back.
Yeah. Well, my answer to that is there's a Bulgarian restaurant called Shishko, Shisko. And it really is my favorite restaurant in Israel. It reminds me of my grandmother's cooking. It's a lot of the same foods that she cooked, like lutenitsa and Bulgarian kebabs and burekas. And I just love it dearly. I go there every single time I'm in Israel.
Where in Israel?
It's in Tel Aviv.
In Tel Aviv? Okay.
It's in Tel Aviv, and it's called Shishko, which in Bulgarian means fat Bulgarian man.
Okay. I'm writing it down. Great. So we're going to take one more break here, and then we're going to play my speed round game and talk some industry news. Stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
I'll be tapping my feet on Grafton Street, and honey, I will sing you a song, and it goes la la la, oh la la, la 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 la, la la la, oh la la, la la la.
Okay, we're back. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Alon Shaya. It's time for my speed round game. So, Alon, what this is I'm going to name a few things, an either-or situation, and you just pick your preference.
Okay.
So, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Cocktail.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Both.
I finally stumped you. You were moving along quickly.
I know.
Okay, both.
I'll give it a both.
Well, was there a comment there? Well, your restaurants are typically, or are, well, no, they're not typically, I was going to say small. You have both.
No, they're both.
Right.
They're both. Yeah. There's a lot of small plates and there's a lot of large plates.
Yeah. Yeah, they both have their purpose. Okay. How about communal table or chef's counter?
Communal table.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Well, that's a tough one. There's a lot, I don't feel like that's a yes or no answer.
Okay. So we're going to skip that one. That's a longer show.
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I can't answer it.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. How about making pita or making pasta?
Oh man, another hard one. making pasta.
Okay. Well, everything you make is delicious. You do make some fine pita
bread. Well, the reason I say
that
is I make pita so that I can zone out. I make pasta when I really want to focus. So, you know,
interesting.
It's more of like an internal quest there.
I love that. That's great. Okay, a few more. Mardi Gras or Jazz Fest?
Oh, another hard one. Mardi Gras.
Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert. Definitely not cheese plate.
Okay. And last one is Manhattan, Brooklyn, New Orleans, or Denver? Might be a hard one, too.
Oh, man. Well, New Orleans and Denver. I'm going to choose both of those.
Okay. Your cities. Great. Well, that's the game. So, industry news. Let's talk about this list that came out yesterday. There are many articles on it, but on Grub Street, we have, here's the full list of the world's 50 best restaurants for 2018 by Hugh Merwin. So we're talking about the world's 50 best, which is this year they were in Bilbao in Spain for the awards part, and it's always a list that's looked at by foodies and just people celebrating some of the best restaurants in the world. So, Osteria Francescana was named the number one restaurant, which it had previously been in a couple years ago. But it's interesting because the top of the list, it's been a lot of the same restaurants, but they kind of switched spots a little bit.
Right.
So I mean, as a chef, as a restaurateur, like what's your take on this list and other lists? Like, do you pay attention? Do you care?
Well, you know, I don't pay attention to the world's 50 best restaurants. I never really read the lists. I do when I go to one of the restaurants that are on the list, and I hear that it's on the list, I'm excited about that. And I think that it's great that I'm sure the people that are on the list are really, you know, very talented and very good at what they do. And I know many of them. I just don't pay attention to, like, who's number one or who's number two or who's number three. I don't put too much attention on that. It doesn't interest me as much as knowing that, like, I'm the neighborhood's favorite restaurant. Like, that to me is what I think is most important, that you're cooking for the people that come right to your restaurant every day and not so that you can be on the list. I think if you end up on a list, great, but I don't believe in, like, the race to the finish line or the request to be number one or number two or number three on that list.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you need, you know, and it's a great philosophy in cooking for the people that are going to come to your restaurant and support you on everyday basis.
If you have a busy restaurant, you're doing great. Mm-hmm. You should just keep it up. And to me, like, that's the most important thing. And I believe that wholeheartedly, that is what brings the soul to a restaurant, is to understand what the people that eat there every day want and what the people that work there every day want. Like, to me, that's the most important thing. When you start thinking about what list you're on, it waters it all down and makes it kind of shallow. So
I guess
that's just my take on it.
Yeah, no, and I guess it's the question I have with lists or accolades is how much impact do they then have on the business and bringing customers in. You know, you've won several Beard Awards, and you know, I wonder, like, do you feel, you know, what has the most impact? And I wonder on this list, like, I think there are people that look at the top 50 and then make it a mission to go to these. I mean, those are rare, you know, these are mostly very expensive restaurants around the world, but, or is it more important just to, you know, be in the local paper and be getting just nice reviews and write-ups, you know? Look, I guess I'm speaking as a publicist.
If you make it on the list, it's like, yeah, I think if you make it on those lists, it's not like you're choosing to do it yourself, right? Like, mm-hmm. people are choosing to get you onto these lists. So from there, it's about what you do with it. And whether or not it's important to you, if you end up on the list, then you have a responsibility to live up to expectations that people have. But what I don't like is when people change what they do because they've made it onto a list, and then they try to kind of overplay it. And then the expectations are way out of whack with what people, like, what your expectations for a restaurant after winning one of those awards would be different than the expectations of the people that have been coming and enjoying the food and the service. And I don't like it when those things become unbalanced. So I think the lists are fine. I think it's important that the people that do win the awards, like, do what they know their team and their customers are going to want from them.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right. And yeah, I'm happy for everyone who's been recognized.
For sure. 100%.
Yeah. And I was in Italy 3 years ago, and I was fortunate to dine at Osteria Francescana and meet Massimo. And I just adore him. Like, he's doing a lot of good in the world too. So
he really is. I've never gotten a chance to meet him, but I'm cooking with him this summer next month at Slow Foods in Denver. So I'm very, very excited about that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I think he, in my opinion, he has this power, like this humanity,
yeah,
like
he's
this
like a superhero
that he just, this warmth. And I feel you're gonna, you'll probably just adore him too.
Yeah,
so,
I can't wait to meet him.
Yeah, he's great. So congratulations to everyone, and stay with us. We're going to take one more break and come back and do my solo dining experience and have the final question. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
What can I say? My brown hair is turning gray. My white teeth are faded to yellow. My waistline's growing, and my bald spot's even showing. I'm no longer a handsome fella.
And we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. So this week, I went to a restaurant called Dez. Here's the rundown. The location, 227 Mulberry Street, Soho, New York City. The concept, contemporary Middle Eastern fast casual. The name Dez means desert. The chef and co-founder, Eden Grishpan of Eden Eats, and her business partner, creative director, Samantha Haber of E Squared Hospitality. So why did I go? Well, because it sounded great, and I'm a fan of Eden's through social media. I follow her at Eden Eats. And I'm friends with E Squared's VP of PR and marketing, Rachel Wormser. So my experience. So it was a beautiful day. I stopped by there for a late lunch. I ordered at the counter. They gave me a little buzzer that I waited to buzz. And once it did, I picked up my food and I got a table outside and enjoyed my meal al fresco. Eden was walking around and I was able to chat with her for a little bit. And that was really nice. So what did I get? I had the jeweled rice bowl with saffron rice, baharat, grilled chicken, pistachios, herbs, and mint lemon yogurt. My take? It was delicious. The chicken was cooked perfectly. It was tender. It was full of flavor. Everything really went very well together. It was a nice combination. The pistachios added a nice texture. The yogurt sauce was light, but had really good flavor. So I liked it. The ambiance. They took inspiration from Middle Eastern markets and Moroccan gardens, so it's decorated with desert icons like palms, cacti, and camels. It has some tables and booths and Moroccan rugs, and there is the outside seating. I'd say it's perfect for a solo meal, or it would be great with friends because she also has a bunch of mezze and salads and pitas and plates that would be good to share. Interesting tidbit. This is Eden's first restaurant. She is a Canadian-Israeli TV star who you may recognize as the host of Cooking Channel's Eden Eats, and she's also been on Top Chef Canada and some other Canadian programs. Personal fun fact, without giving too much away, there's someone at E Squared who is a tenant of someone in my family, and so our worlds kind of collided that way in a business-to-personal relationship way just by chance living in New York City. The cost, $12, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes, I would. I'd like to try more of the menu. The website is inthedez.com. So I dine out a lot solo, but Alan, I was thinking of you with this one because I thought the, you know, type of cuisine was crossed a bit with what you do.
Yeah. I follow Eden on Instagram too, and I'm a huge fan of hers.
Yeah, she's great, and she had a baby, and I don't know, just watching her and her whole lifestyle, she always seems very happy and in good spirits, which is nice. So
yeah,
okay.
I can't wait to come try our restaurant.
Yeah, it's cool. It's I think when you come to town, we can go back. We can share some mezze together.
I would love that.
Me too. Okay, so it's time for the final question. So my next guest is Jenny Dirksen. She is the National Director of Chef and Culinary Relations at No Kid Hungry. So Alan, what would you like to ask Jenny?
Man, I was actually just texting with Jenny earlier today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Small world.
She's awesome. I would like to ask Jenny how she, what kind of advice she could give to me to do more community service in the community as we enter, we have the Shia Barnett Foundation. We do work here in New Orleans, and we want to also do stuff in Denver. And so I would like to kind of pick her brain and ask her, what advice would she have to someone that was going into a city that they haven't been to before and wanted to make an impact in the community?
Wow. It's a great question. And it's it just shows your character and who you are for asking that question. So impressive. And I will find out.
Sweet.
Yes. So
cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for making this happen. And I'm just a huge fan of you and everything you do, and I can't wait to try your new restaurants, and I wish you just much continued success.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you soon.
Me too. I have to find out what events you're going to be at.
Come to Slow Foods in Denver and come see Massimo and I.
Okay. Okay. I'm very tempted. Right. I'm going to look at the dates.
That doesn't sound like a bad idea, right?
Yeah, no, it does not at all. Okay, so thank you so much. It's been great chatting with you. Bye. My guest today has been Alon Shaya. He's award-winning chef and owner of Pomegranate Hospitality that includes Saba in New Orleans and soon to open Safta in Denver. His cookbook memoir is out. It's called Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. You can find him at pomhospitality.com and eatwithsaba.com are his websites, and on social media at Alon Shaya at Palm Hospitality. You can find me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My website's bayerpublicrelations.com and sherrybayer.com. It is our summer fun drive here at Heritage Radio Network. It's going from June 19th to July 31st. You can join the Heritage Radio Network community and become a member and support us, and we would greatly appreciate it. To donate and become a member, you can go to heritageradionetwork.org. Also, same website, you can find all of my archived shows. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks again to my guest, Alon, and thanks to my show's engineer, Vitor Hirsch. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with another live show. I hope you'll tune in then, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.